You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
We've all heard of the God of Hammers. The God of Lightning, Thor. Norse mythology is one of the most widely studied and disseminated mythologies today, next to Greek or Roman and Egyptian. But, of course, Thor took on a new life in pop culture as the Asgardian hero in his own and the Avengers comic books. Hopefully, we also know that those stories are not mythically accurate, but you can see how the hero of the long past is reshaped into a hero of the 1960s and then again and again and again in his continuing comics and also differently in the movies and series that come out today. But, to disappoint, that's not the pop culture version I'll be talking about today. No, I'll be talking about a little gray alien played by a puppet and sometimes CGI and voiced by Michael Shanks, the same actor as Dr. Daniel Jackson. Earth's favorite little alien from another galaxy, Thor. My name is Renee, you're listening to Detours in Archaeology, and this is The Alien Nature of Thor. Thor's Hammer. Thor's Hammer. In the classic style of 90s TV shows, there is a rundown of all the mythology / science that'll be expected to play out in the episode within the first 5 minutes. Then they can get to the action and the actual story. In the first episode featuring the Norse gods, Daniel discusses two types of sky gods. The tyrants, who mythologically, at least in the show, use their magic, or technology rather, to subjugate, to punish and control, equated to the Goa'uld. And the culture bearers, who use their technology to help and benefit humans. The example Daniel gave was the Vikings, for the Norse gods. He explained that they were powerful warriors, especially Thor, who used his hammer, not naming it by the way, which released lightning and thunder on enemies of mankind like the Ettins. The team surmises that the hammer is potentially an energy-based weapon that they'd like access to, along with making new allies. And because the plot needs a way for the team to get to the place where the Norse gods might be found, Tilk recognizes Thor's hammer as a symbol for a world called Cimmeria, where the Goa'uld would forbid others of their own kind from going. The way they pronounced Cimmeria in the first episode made it sound like Sumeria, and without subtitles, I never would have known. Initially, I wondered why the ancient Egyptian coded gods would call a place they'd never go the same as a place that, yeah, they were adversarial at times, but the nations were long-standing trade partners, Sumeria and Egypt. Then, I did a little bit more research, and Cimmeria, Land of Darkness and Night, is a story about the home of Conan the Cimmerian as a direct descendant of the Atlanteans, the backstory for Robert E. Howard's fantasy novel series. This description would make more sense with a place of dread for the Goa'uld who invoked the warning, used by the writers of the show, not the actual Goa'uld themselves. It also was an ancient name of Crimea, a peninsula in the northern part of the Black Sea. The Bosporan Kingdom was also referred to as Cimmeria. And also, Crimaria was an ancient microcontinent separating the Paleotethys and the Neotethys oceans. But I don't think that has anything to do with the show. The show played its typical triumphant horn music while we're viewing the residents of this new world, before the Stargate opens and the team comes through. When the Stargate's opening, it's a little bit more wary music. The Cimmerians around the gate laugh and chant Thor, Thor, Thor repeatedly. The hammer powers up and scans the team before focusing on Tilk with his symbiote and transporting him and Jack, who grabbed Tilk to help, to a labyrinth. The exit of which was the actual Thor's hammer, an energy field that blocked any Goa'uld from leaving alive. So they weren't really wrong when they said energy-based weapon. Skipping forward, Thor's chariot and the Hall of Thor's might. It is the Hall of Thor's powers to defend, which Daniel hopes is a weapon, because the Goa'uld and their motherships are on the planet now after they destroyed Thor's hammer. In the story, Daniel and Sam come to an obelisk that the people of Samaria are told is forbidden to touch. Daniel touches it anyway, and they get transported to an actual hall area in which tests were put in place. The first was a test of bravery and compassion, or at least that was the outcome of how they reacted to what happened. And the second was of knowledge through the riddle of the runes. Riddles were words, ideas, and, according to the show, later numbers. This is not incorrect, but in the show, they describe the P to protective power and the number 3. C, with the extra lines on the side, are the dice cup or fate and 14. M is movement or horse is 15. R is Thor's chariot or a wagon and the number 9. But those are not the original meanings, nor the numerical values that are ascribed to the runes, as they didn't even usually have specific numerical values in the first place, other than on a calendar, and then they were ascribed to the art of magical rune casting as a form of divination. But these numbers generally match their arrangement in the alphabet, so in the show, they're not all correct. P actually would mean joy, and was the number 8. 3 is actually the Thorn Rune, which is a line and a little triangle in the middle of it, and would have connected to Thor, as that is the first letter of his name spelled in runes, and in Icelandic today. The C with the two extra lines, the meaning is actually unknown, but possibly means pear tree. The C could mean a dice cup or fate, but there are so many variations on what they all mean, so it's unclear. And is the number 14, so that matches. M does mean movement, so they're right about that, but it is the number 19, not 15, which is the yew tree rune, the Ewats, which looks almost like a trident because it has 3 lines sticking up from one single, and it means protection, or the Yggdrasil world tree. R means a ride or journey, which could be taken in a wagon or chariot, so sure. It also symbolizes 5, so that's not quite right. And 9 is the H with 2 slanted lines in between the parallel lines. But depending on when and where you look, in terms of history and different sources, they have very different information, which makes getting meaning right is even more difficult. Plus, the Vikings had pentadic numerals that act similar as Roman numerals, so I wonder why they didn't just use those. But I guess it wouldn't have been as much of a riddle. Which brings up the final wall art that they barely look at. There is a large scene painted out with a circle showing 2 diameters crossing each other, or 4 radii, and can look like a very simple wagon wheel. However, because the characters barely mention it and barely even look, I guess it proves that there's multiple ways to work through a riddle, even though they picked up on the right solution, even using technically incorrect information. Bat-eared listeners will maybe have put together that 3, 14, 15, 9 is the first 6 numbers of pi. And so Daniel draws a radius in the circle to depict pi. That reveals Thor not as the Viking warrior that he was shown as, but as a match of the Roswell Greys, making it clear that the reason for the reveal is because they finally grew wise enough to see them as they really are. The difference between Thor in Norse mythology and Thor in Stargate SG-1 is, of course, astonishing. Thor in Norse mythology is not a little gray alien walking around naked because they have no genitalia to hide. And no shame either, but why would they? There's also no puppet or CGI in actual Norse mythology. But in Norse mythology, during the first episode and most of the second episode that Thor appears in, he looks like a Norse god with a curly brown beard, long wavy hair. He's wearing authentic Norse helmet with no horns, wielding Mjolnir, dressed in studded armor, arm bracers and arm decoration, rings made out of metal, and a deep booming voice. This version of him is played by Mark Gibbon and is the closest to the actual Norse god that we get to see, though it is a hologram. The real Thor is the little gray alien, much like those described in many a science fiction story, especially from the 50s and 60s following Roswell. The alien race, the Asgard, is very short, maybe 3 to 4 feet tall, very lanky, and ridiculously intelligent. More so than Thor in the Marvel Universe. He's kind of depicted as kind and a bit dumb, kind of like a himbo, but he's actually quite clever because he understands science that we don't know on Earth yet. The Stargate Asgard Thor is much smarter than that, and they were part of an alliance of 4 races that formed a collective of genius aliens. The others being the Nox and the Furlings, the latter of whom we never actually get to meet in the series. Also, the last race of aliens was known as the Ancients, who were the builders of the Stargates. As O'Neill says the first time he meets the Asgard, after downloading all the Ancients' knowledge in his head and then having it removed by the Asgard, is a pretty heady group, and he would be right. Thor, in particular, is the supreme commander of the Asgard fleet, leader of ships across galaxies because they travel between galaxies, and he fights the Goa'uld and the Replicators, although he later does need help often from the humans, especially Zam, because he can't think of a way that's dumb enough to defeat the Replicators. After several adventures, he's already a huge fan of Jack O'Neill and the rest of the team, and they always go to them for help because it seems like they constantly need it. Other episodes with Thor in them include Fair Game, Nemesis, Small Victories, Revelations, Descent, Prometheus, Unnatural Selection, Disclosure, Fragile Balance, New Order Part 1 and New Order Part 2, Ripple Effect, and Unending. They are nothing like the Aesir in Norse mythology. The aliens may only seem that way because of their advanced technology, but let's dive into the identical attributes and the gods' personalities to see where Thor's might overlap. In the Poetic Edda, compiled during the 13th century from traditional source material reaching into the pagan period, Thor appears, or is mentioned at least, in the poems of the Völuspá, Grímnismál, and of many poems that I am not going to try to list because I will not pronounce them correctly. If you want to see them, they are on the article page on my website with links. He's also talked about in the Prose Edda in all 4 books, and in Heimskringla, also composed by Snorri Sturluson. Thor, or at least statues of Thor, are mentioned in 4 of the sagas. If you sometimes see the weird letter P, that one that has the triangle shape or the circular shape in the center, that's actually the letter Thorn, a rune that was once part of the Old English alphabet and still exists in the Icelandic alphabet, making the th sound, which is why Thor is spelled like that. As has been corrected in many articles, podcasts, and videos before this one, the version in the Marvel comic books and films is not mythologically accurate. He was not the brother of Loki, and is never depicted as clean-shaven or blonde-haired, except for Chapter 3 of the Prose Edda, which was from 1220 CE. The mythography of earlier Norse myths was reworked by Icelander Snorri Sturluson into one structured account, but it was written from a Christian context. Elsewhere, Thor is always described with long red hair and a red beard, and pretty much always a big brawny guy. Which, Stargate does get closer, as mentioned in the earlier episode synopsis. The actor that they got, who played several other characters, featured and background throughout the show's run, had brown hair, not red. But just in general, Thor is the Norse god of thunder, the sky, and agriculture. He is the son of Odin, chief of the gods, and Odin's consort, Jord, who is Earth. And Thor is the husband of the fertility god Sif, who is the mother of his son Modi and daughter Thrud. And his other son, Magni, may be from a union with the giantess Jarlsaxa. Thor has 3 valuable treasures. First one is obvious, Mjolnir, which the frost giants and the mountain giants well know when it's raised, for he has split many a skull of fathers and friends. Translated quote from the Prose Edda. His second is the belt of strength. The second is the belt of strength, Mjolnir, which doubles his strength when worn. The third are iron gloves, Jotgrip, or Jotgrof, that Thor needs to wear to wield his hammer, With these tools, Thor could be the defender of Asgard, the realm of the gods, and Midgard, the human realm, and is primarily associated with protection through great feats of arms in slaying giants, frost or otherwise. The majority of tales featuring Thor put him in conflict with a giant or with his nemesis, the Midgard serpent Jormungandr, the world serpent. He is one of Loki's sons, and after being thrown into the ocean, became the monster snake who coils and twists himself around the world. So, like Heracles in his club, a knight having a sword and shield, a regular person having a computer, diminishing returns with each example there is a power or knowledge without the equipment. At least I hope so for that one. But they give it more of a direction, an extra boon. But it wasn't just me who made the Heracles comparison, though I suppose in this case Hercules would be more correct because it was the Romans when they encountered what would become the Norse religion. This history is based on the writings of the Roman historian Tacitus's late 1st century work Germania about the religion of Suebi from a confederation of Germanic peoples. Thor is thought to have evolved from the earlier Germanic god Donar and emerged as the most revered deity in the Norse pantheon. His influence endures today, reflecting in the modern English and German names for the fifth day of the week, Thursday, and Donnerstag, which both reference Thor and Donar, Thor's Day, Donar's Day. Thor's prominence reached its height during the Viking Age, approximately 790 to 1100 CE, when he was seen as the primary rival to Christ as Christianity started to spread throughout Scandinavia from the 10th century onward. This period is evidenced by the large number of amulets and charms featuring Thor's hammer, symbolizing the religious struggle between North paganism and the emerging Christian faith. Ultimately, Christianity prevailed, and by the 12th century, the veneration of Thor gradually declined in favor of the new religion. Though this interpretation could be reminiscent of the more ancient origination of Thor that was imported to or evolved as people moved over land, water, and through time to become what we now consider to be Thor. He closely parallels other Indo-European thunder deities, such as the Celtic Tyrannus, the Estonian Tara or Tharapita, the Baltic Barkunas, the Slavic Peran, and notably, the Hindu Idira, whose thunderbolt weapon, the Vajra, presents an evident similarity. Scholars have drawn comparisons between Idira's defeat of Vritra and Thor's battle with Jormungandr. While earlier views posited Thor as either an indigenous sky god or a Viking Age Scandinavian import, the presence of these Indo-European connections has led to a consensus that Thor ultimately descends from a proto-Indo-European deity. In Georges Dumézil's Trifunctional Hypothesis of Indo-European Religion, Thor represents the second function, which is strength. Dumézil notes that over time, Thor no longer leads armies, and many roles have instead been taken over by Odin. Several scholars also connect Thor to fertility, especially in later folklore and in the Sami figure Horagavs, which means good man Thor, who reflects him. Dumézil explained that this is a peasant tradition that preserves only the results of the gods' atmospheric battles, the life-giving rain. Thor, beyond his role as a warrior and defender of societal order, was also significant in promoting agriculture and fertility. Others emphasized Thor's close bond with humanity in everyday life. The cult of Thor was connected to men's homes and belongings, as well as the health of the family and community. This included the fertility of the fields. Although Thor is mainly shown as a storm god in myths, he also played a role in fertility and maintaining the seasonal cycle. Even today, ancient stone axes have been used as fertility symbols placed in holes for the first spring seed. Thor arrives on Earth with the thunderstorm, bringing rain that makes fields fertile. Thus, Thor and Odin continue the cult of the sky gods known since the Bronze Age. This aspect is evident in his blessing of the lands settled by the first Icelanders, reflecting his identity as a sky god associated with the rain essential for crop growth. The 11th century German historian Adam of Bremen highlights this, stating, "Thor, they say, presides over the air, which governs the thunder and lightning, the winds and rains, fair weather, and crops." Thor's mare Sif, known primarily for her golden hair, symbolizes fields of grain. The golden-haired goddess, only briefly mentioned in myths, likely recalls an old symbol of the divine marriage between the sky god and the earth goddess. Their marriage represents a hierogamy, or divine marriage, common among Indo-European cultures, a typical uniting of deities. This union symbolizes the fertility of land and the resulting prosperity of the people through the sexual connection between the sky and earth. Moving to Mjolnir, Scandinavia has a tradition of wearing jewelry pendants shaped like tools as necklaces. In Scandinavian countries, as well as those that experienced expanding migration from the region, that pendant is in the shape of Mjolnir, the hammer of Thor or Donar. Mjolnir is an extension of the solar god's hammer or battle axe of light, which was used and brought to importance to crush, pound, or grind the solid grains. This was both meant literally for food and metaphorically for knowledge, just as Thor's hammer was used to crush the frost giants to help the people of Midgard, Earth. This conclusion is arrived at based on the language transliteration. Mjolnir is believed to come originally from the Proto-Germanic language word mjallinn, meaning to grind or mill, wheat or flour, and ultimately the Sanskrit marnati, meaning to crush, smash, slay. Mjolnir itself is thought to have the power to level mountains. Quote, then Brokkr, one of the two dwarfs who crafted Mjolnir, gave the hammer to Thor and said that Thor might smite as hard as he desired, whatsoever might be before him, and the hammer would not fail. And if he threw it at anything, it would never miss, and never fly so far as to not return to his hand. And if be desired, he might keep it in his sark, shirt, it was so small. This was the Aesir's decision that the hammer was the best of all the precious works, and in there the greatest defense against the rime giants, from the prose or poetic Edda. This shows Mjolnir as more than just a normal weapon, although it's a very good weapon. It was even said to be a tool to create and maintain order from the chaos and anarchy of the Utengard, the outside. The hammer was used in formal ceremonies to bless marriages, births, and possibly funerals as well. In one episode from the prose Edda, Thor would often kill and eat his goats, then bring them back to life by hollowing their bones with his hammer. The medieval Danish historian Saxo Grammaticus records that huge hammers were kept in one of Thor's temples in Sweden, and that periodically the people would hold a ritual there that involved beating the hammers against some kind of drum that would sound like thunder. This could have been a ceremony to bless and protect the community and ward off hostile spirits. What's clear is that the hammer itself is not technically what contains the magic, like an energy weapon would. Instead, it's more like what is presented in the Marvel comics, movies, and TV shows. It's like a superconductor for Thor's divine power that can funnel it into a single blast or a concussive booming hit. It has to be specifically wielded and specifically and specially made by the dwarves, giant space dwarves in the comics, I guess, to be able to harness Thor's power without being destroyed. But even he needs some help wielding it with the belt and the gloves. Let's talk about the myth of Mjolnir getting made, because it's funny. The whole story began with Loki cutting off Sif's hair, which is known to be the most beautiful golden hair of all the Aesir. Another thing that Marvel got oh so wrong, even though they did play through an aftermath of this story early in Loki season 1. Thor's wife, and another thing they got wrong, was understandably pissed at Loki and made him fix it. Instead of him just magicking her hair back, which I presume he could have done if he wanted to, he went to the dwarven Sons of Ivaldi and asked them to forge new hair for Sif, along with Skibrania, the flying ship of Freyr, and Grognir, the spear belonging to Odin. And because Loki couldn't leave well enough alone, he made a bet with another pair of dwarf brothers, Sindri and Brokkr, challenging them to create items of greater beauty than those made by the Sons of Ivaldi, a rival group of dwarves. The prize for the creation of such gifts was Loki's head. Sindri and Brokkr began their work creating the golden-haired boar, Rutinbursti, for Freyr, and the ring Draupnir, which could reproduce itself, for Odin. Loki was going to lose the bet and his head, so wanting to prevent the creation of the gods' treasures, disguised himself as a fly and buzzed around the dwarven brothers as they forged the last item, the hammer. Loki bit one of the dwarf brothers, whichever one was working on the bellows, to keep the forge hot enough, and caused him to flinch and momentarily lose control of the bellows, resulting in a manufacturing defect that led to an unusually short handle on the hammer. The intended design was for a longer two-handed weapon, but Loki's interference made it a one-handed tool. Despite this imperfection, the gods deemed Mjolnir worthy and the greatest of treasures, making it Thor's primary weapon. The short handle ultimately became a characteristic feature of the hammer in Norse mythology, and Loki, still having lost the bet, tried to escape paying the price by arguing that while he promised his head, he had not promised his neck. The dwarves, with the other gods' consent, sewed Loki's mouth shut to prevent him from speaking further lies, which unfortunately didn't last long. There are other myths, of course, about Thor and Mjolnir. In another famous myth, Mjolnir was stolen by the giant Thrym to force the gods to give him the hand of Freya, the goddess of love and beauty, in marriage, which of course she was readily against. Before the gods found out that it was Thrym, Thor assumed that it was Loki and made him help. Loki, not wanting to get beaten up, borrowed Freya's feather cloak and flew to Jotunheim and found Thrym, who confessed to stealing the hammer in exchange for Freya. In a clever plot, Heimdall suggests disguising Thor as Freya and even borrowing her necklace, Brisingamen, as the finishing touch. Thor goes along with the plan, pretending to be the giant's bride while Loki would pose as his maidservant to get Mjolnir back. They ride in on Thor's chariot, and when the feast starts, Thor devours entire animals and drinks 3 casks of mead with a fierce appetite. Thrym, surprised by this behavior, which conflicts with his expectations of Freya, is reassured by the maid Loki, who explains that Freya has not eaten for 8 days out of eagerness to arrive. When Thrym lifts Freya's veil to kiss her, he is met with terrifying, fiery eyes. Loki attributes this to Freya having stayed awake for 8 nights. Then the Jotar's quote-unquote wretched sister requests a bridal gift from Freya, and the giants produce Mjolnir to bless the bride by placing it on her lap, marrying the two through the goddess Var. Although, when Mjolnir is presented, Thor grabbed it and promptly did some killing, and he smashed the skulls of all the giants in attendance. This myth connects to ancient rites, which is shown on a Bronze Age rock carving from Scandinavia that apparently depicts a couple being blessed by a larger figure holding a hammer, which indicates the considerable antiquity of this notion. It's been suggested by historians that this part of the blessing consisted of imparting fertility to the couple, which would make sense in light of Thor's connections with agriculture and fertilization of the fields. The existence of this rite is assumed in the tale when the giants stole Thor's hammer, and to be married to one of the giants, knowing that the hammer would be presented during the ceremony. Beyond its power to level mountains and control storms, Mjolnir is also a sacred object used in rituals and ceremonies. It symbolized fertility and prosperity and was used to bless marriages and consecration events, making it a tool for both destruction and sanctity. It also served as a symbol of protection, with both Viking warriors and everyday people, including women, wearing Mjolnir amulets for strength and courage, and they often appeared in women's graves too. Just so you know, this also includes the swastika, which has been identified as representing the hammer or lightning of Thor, and dated all the way back to the migration period, and has been seen on a multitude of artifacts from the 3rd century. English scholar Hilda Ellis Davison, who studied and worked at the University of Cambridge, comments that the form of the swastika primarily had connections with light and fire and would have been linked with the sun wheel. It may have been linked to Thor's lightning and was used as an alternative to the hammer because it is found on memorial stones in Scandinavia beside the inscriptions to Thor. When it's found on the pommel of a warrior's sword and on his sword belt, scholars assume that the warrior was placing himself under the thunder god's protection. but the Nazis ruined everything, so I'm going to stop diving into that there. The hammer was a significant symbol of power, strength, and control. It certainly destroyed, but in Stargate, the hammer was more of an energy field that would kill the Goa'uld and let humans pass through. On Earth, it's a symbol of strength and protection, which it does seem to embody as it protects humans from the demons. Goa'uld, or Ettins, I suppose would just be the outsiders, the Utens. Thor's chariot, pulled by the goats Tangrisnir, in Old Norse literally meaning teeth grinder or one who grinds teeth, and Tanniost, meaning teeth thin or one that has gaps between his teeth. Both of the stories in the Poetic Edda and the Prose Edda, both written or compiled in the 13th century, contain stories that feature the chariot pulled by goats. Scholars have commented that the names were really young when they were recorded and may have actually been inventions of Sturluson. In the Prose Edda, Odin is telling a story to Grangrir that when Thor is riding on his chariot, he is known as Oku Thor, other than Asa Thor, which means God Thor, because Oku means driver or rider. He says every day, Thor cooks the goats and, using Mjolnir, resurrects them the next day. According to one story that Odin says, Thor and Loki once did a night at the home of peasant farmers for a feast of his large goats while they were on their way to Utgard Loki. One of their children, the son, Thjalfi, broke one of the bones to suck out the marrow. The next morning, one of the goats, the one with the broken bone, still had a broken leg, resulting in lameness upon resurrection. As a result, Thor keeps Hrafni and his sister, Röskva, as his servants, even though the daughter did nothing wrong. They pull the chariot, not necessarily with Thor and Loki inside it, to their destination. Scholars have linked the ever-replenishing goats to the nightly-consumed beast Saehrimnir in Norse mythology and Scandinavian folk beliefs, involving herring bones and witchcraft, which doesn't appear anywhere else in the legend. In Stargate SG-1, there is no chariots and no goats to be seen. When it comes to Thor's chariot in the show, it is, of course, a massive spaceship. It's a Asgardian mothership that Teal'c has heard stories about from Jaffa legend. Thorvangr in Norse mythology means power field and is sometimes anglicized as Thrudvang or Thrudvang, and is the field where the god Thor resides. Written in both the Prose Edda and Heimskringla by Snorri Sturluson. In the Prose Edda book Gylfaginning, the enthroned figure of Hæ or Hör, who is Odin in disguise, tells Gangrir, who is apparently King Gylfi in disguise, about how the god Thor is the strongest of all the gods and men, and that Thor's realm is Thrudvang, and that his hall is called Bískilnir, the largest of all houses that men ever made. Further into the Gylfaginning, Hæ, or Odin, mentions that Thor returned to Thrudvangr after Utgard Loki's fortress disappeared, which is a story we will get to. In the Prose Edda book Skaldskaparmál, Thor's battle with Hrungnir is recounted. The narration details that after defeating Hrungnir, leaving a whetstone lodged in his head, Thor returned to Thrudvangr, where the Völva Gro unsuccessfully attempted to remove the stone. In the Heimskringla book, Ylinga Saga, the field is again mentioned, but in a way that tries to connect with a real historical context. Here, Thor is a temple priest, and given Thrudvangr a location in Sweden by Odin, who is here described as a powerful king rather than a god, all but to get around the Christianization of the area. To get at the attributes and character of Thor, I'm going to tell you a few more myths. Depending on the country, Thor might have represented something slightly different from others. Most of the writings that we still possess come from the Icelandic sagas and the Poetic and Prose Eddas. The mythology there is expansive, especially regarding Thor, as he was such a major character. The story that feature the god, besides noting his strength and impatient with delays, all emphasize his reliability. Even when Thor is tricked or outsmarted, his past victories and assurance of future triumphs give him the mental fortitude to keep going. He may not win a battle, but will eventually win the war. This concept is examined in chapter 44 of the Prose Edda when the storyteller Hai responds to a question about Thor's victories and his defeats. Some stories where Thor doesn't win are among the most famous. One involves the castle of Utgard-Loki, a giant, and three tricks played on Thor. Generally, it's a continuation of the story where Thor gets the children as servants after having the goat feast. He, his servants, and Loki encounter Skrymnir, who ties their food bag very tightly, preventing Thor from opening it. Thor tries to attack Skrymnir three times while he's sleeping, but each time Skrymnir wakes and asks if a leaf or an acorn had fallen on his head. Afterward, they reach Utgard-Loki's stronghold, where the giant mocks their size. To stay, they have to compete in contests. Loki loses a speed-eating contest to Logi, who eats the meat, bones, and the trough itself. Thralfi loses a race three times to Hugi. When it's Thor's turn, he chooses a drinking contest, but can't empty a large horn after three huge drinks. Utgard-Loki mocks him and offers the challenge of lifting a large gray cat off the floor. Thor can only manage to lift it high enough so that one paw is left on the floor. And once again, Utgard-Loki mocks Thor, saying that he can try to wrestle an old woman, his nurse Ellie. Thor and Ellie grapple through the hall until Thor is finally forced down on one knee. At this point, Utgard-Loki calls off the contest and allows the three or four to spend the night, depending on if the sister is with them or not. Either right after or in the morning, Utgard-Loki reveals the truth. He was Skrymnir in the forest, and Thor's blows actually struck mountains rather than his head, creating giant dents in the earth. The contests inside the castle were also deceptive, and their opponents were Wildfire and Thought. According to Utgard-Loki, in Thor's contest, the drinking horn's bottom was connected to the sea. No matter how much Thor drank, he couldn't empty it. Although he did manage to drink so much that the sea level dropped, creating massive tide changes. The gray cat was actually the Midgard serpent, which encircles the world, and Thor even being able to rise it as high as he did, getting three paws off the ground, was extremely dangerous for the stability of the world. The old woman he wrestled was none other than old age itself, which is unbeatable. Utgard-Loki mentioned that everyone was amazed and impressed when Thor was only forced down to one knee. Thor responds to his speech by pulling out his hammer to crush Utgard-Loki's skull. But with that, the giant vanished, along with his entire stronghold. Thor and his companions leave the giant's land, but Thor vows revenge on the Midgard serpent for getting the upper hand. Not long after, he goes fishing with the giant Hymir and manages to catch the serpent. However, Hymir is terrified of drowning since Thor's fight with the beast is putting their boat at risk and cuts the line. Thor is pissed. The Midgard serpent escapes, and Thor, after tossing Hymir overboard, wades ashore. Neither of these stories really shows Thor at his best, as he's tricked in the first, and betrayed just as he's about to bring the serpent aboard in the second, and gets really, really angry in both. Yet he remains a heroic figure, since his flaws are apparently beyond his control. And no one would have fared better against Utgard-Loki's magic. In another story, Thor is the central figure in Harbarskjolf, where after journeying from the east, he arrives at an inlet and meets a ferryman named Harbord, who is another guise of Odin, presumably. Thor requests passage, but the ferryman, shouting from the shore, responds with immediate rudeness and refuses to ferry him. Initially, Thor remains silent, yet Harbord grows increasingly hostile, leading the poem into a contest of verbal insults between the two. Throughout their exchange, various lore is unveiled, including Thor's slaying of multiple Jotnar in the east, and women in Helsley, which is now known as the Danish island of Læsø. Unfortunately, Thor is left to continue on foot because the ferryman couldn't care less. In the poem Hymiskvida, Thor is again the central figure who, after the gods finish hunting and eating, feel the urge to drink, as gods do. The gods shake twigs to interpret messages and decide to find suitable cauldrons at Aegir's house. When Thor arrives, Aegir is cheerful but annoyed, telling Thor that the gods must first bring a suitable cauldron to brew ale. Unable to find one deep enough and large enough, the gods learn from Tyr that Hymir, who lives east of Eligvar, owns a super deep kettle. Thor secures his goats at Aegir's home, and then he and Tyr visit Hymir's hall seeking the large cauldron. They are welcomed by Tyr's 900-headed grandmother and his gold-clad mother, who offers them a horn. Despite Hymir's displeasure at Thor's arrival, Tyr's mother helps them find a strong cauldron. Thor consumes a large meal of two oxen, others eat just one, and then sleeps. The next morning, Thor announces plans to fish that evening and requests bait. Hymir directs him to his pasture, expecting no issue. Thor then retrieves Hymir's best oxen and violently removes its head to use as bait. After a gap in the manuscript, which is called a lacuna, the Hymiskvida resumes with Thor and Hymir at the sea on the boat. Hymir catches several whales simultaneously while Thor baits his fishing line with the ox's head. When Thor casts his line, Jormungandr bites it. He hauls a serpent up and strikes his head fiercely with a hammer, causing Jormungandr to shriek, and an underwater uproar ensues before another gap appears in the text. Following this gap, Hymir is silent and displeased, they row back to shore. Upon arrival, Hymir asks Thor to help carry a whale back to his farm. Thor effortlessly lifts both the boat and the whales and transport them all back to Hymir's farm. Later, prompted by Tyr's mother, Thor throws a crystal goblet and shatters it against Hymir's head because there was a bet. If you can break this, then I'll give you my cauldron. And Tyr's mother told him how to break it, and it does. As a reward, Thor and Tyr receive the cauldron. While Tyr is unable to lift it, Thor manages to roll the cauldron away with them. They travel away from Hymir's farm. They are attacked by an army of many-headed creatures led by Hymir, but Thor slays him with his hammer. They successfully bring the cauldron back, ensuring that they have plentiful ale and thus continue Aegir's feast each winter. As his most important attribute, or at least most well-known, Thor is frequently wielding Mjolnir against the giants, the Jotunar, emphasizing his role as protector of the gods and humanity. Each battle highlights the relentless struggle between the gods and the forces of chaos represented by the giants, creating the difference between the world safe, or made for humans, versus the outside, the dangerous world that the gods have not conquered for us, or rather, with us. Viking-age Scandinavians especially revered Thor not only as a guide across the seas due to his regular pushing the boundaries against Ingard and Utgard, but also as a protector of storms since he could also bring them about, and especially, obviously, as a champion in battle. All of these stories embellish Thor's strength, which is his main feature, as well as Thor's quick temper, as he often shows impatience with following others' rules. I couldn't find a single myth depicting Thor as a subtle or careful character, and he prefers direct action over discussion or planning in solving any problem. Thor is only shown with guile or the capacity to deceive when Heimdall tells him to crossdress, so Thor cannot recognize these qualities in others, and as a result, he is often tricked by magical spells or shape-shifting entities. Thor's role is seen in archaeological findings that trace the veneration of Thor back to the Bronze Age, highlighting how his cult evolved over time and across regions. A consistent feature from the Bronze Age through the Viking Age is Thor's role as chief deity of the second tier in the traditional European three-tiered social hierarchy, specifically the warrior and military function. The first tier represented rulers and sovereignty, while the third encompassed farmers and fertility. Notably, Thor maintained strong ties to the third function, a connection that deepened during the Viking Age, a period marked by social upheaval and change, elevating him as the primary god of the common people in Scandinavia and its Viking colonies. This social role becomes clear when contrasted with Odin, Thor's functional counterpart. Odin was the favored deity of rulers, outcasts, and social elites, embodying values such as ecstasy, knowledge, magical power, and creative agency. These refined traits starkly contrast with Thor's more accessible and grounded virtues. The Eddas and the sagas often depict tension between the gods. For instance, Odin mocks Thor for claiming Odins are the nobles who fall in battle, but Thors are the thralls, whatever that really means. Another episode shows Odin bestowing blessings on his champion Stuttgart, which Thor counters with curses. In particular, Odin grants Stuttgart a favor among nobility, while Thor proclaims he will be scorned by common folk. During the Viking Age, circa 793 to around 1000 CE, demographic shifts blurred the distinctions between the second and third functions of Norse deities, resulting in Thor's rising prominence at Odin's expense. Earlier, Odin and his Anglo-Saxon and continental counterparts held the chief positions among the gods, but by the later Viking Age, Thor had become described as the foremost of all the Aesir. This change was especially marked in Iceland, which was settled in the 9th century by colonists who had fled the opposing rule of a Norwegian king who was devoted to Odin. The Icelandic sagas emphasize Thor's veneration, with the Landnámabók revealing about a quarter of the approximately 4,000 settlers bore names referencing Thor. In these late Viking Age Icelandic texts, Thor emerges not only as the chief god of the settlers, but also as the protector of their settlements. Ensuring laws are followed, there is stability, and subsequently, civilization. Thor's appeal extended beyond the Viking warrior. His strength and straightforward problem-solving made him accessible to all social classes. Housewives, farmers, weavers, and brewers alike invoked Thor for assistance with everyday challenges, demonstrating his role as the dependable god of the everyman. Consequently, Thor became the Norse deity who embodied common sense and reliability, even though his myths don't always show that, a figure to whom everyone could relate and depend on. Though Thor is doomed to die at Ragnarok, the end of the world and twilight of the gods, but he only falls after killing Jormungandr with his powerful hammer Mjolnir, and he walks a few steps before inevitably dying due to its poison. His sons, Magni and Modi, survive the end and subsequent rebirth of the world along with a small number of other gods and inherit his hammer, which they use to restore order. But if we want to compare the personalities of these completely different versions, it's pretty difficult because they are seemingly nothing alike. The mythological seems like a hot-headed, hubristic hero from the Hellenized ancient Greece. But hubris is not much of a fatal flaw in Norse mythology, or rather, for Thor himself. He always saves the day, but is constantly getting into fights because he's bored. But his bravery and chutzpah are dependent upon, more or less so depending on the story. He has a wife, Sif, and children, the latter whom survive Ragnarok, and he goes out as a hero, killing the Jormungandr serpent for a new world to actually continue. The alien Thor is brave as a supreme commander, but he appears calm through every problem. He's aloof, and that seems to be the Asgard way. He doesn't really help the humans of Earth that much, at least not directly, because we are still too young, but he and the rest of the Asgard constantly need SG-1's help. They keep warning the team not to do things and sometimes bailing them out of the trouble they get themselves into. At the end of the series, the Asgard finally give the Earth ship all of the Asgard upgrades and knowledge, since the cloning process led to the entire civilization degrading too much to continue, which sort of causes all the issues of the final episode and the final season. But either way, they're still very calm and kind and wipe out any of the evil wherever they can. Just like how they are first introduced, the Asgard and Thor specifically, as a friend to humans, and while telling people what they shouldn't do, and almost perhaps slowing development a bit, the humans of Earth saw that we could be brave and wise after they were gone, and pick up the mantle. And that's really what the show is all about, the optimistic view of our future that shows us what the best of us can become. Thor is one of the highest ranking leaders of the Asgard, so that is mythologically accurate, but there is never any mention of Odin or any female Asgardians from mythology. We only ever hear about or meet Freyr, Heimdall, and Loki. This may be due to the cloning they underwent, where they don't really seem to have any genders since they reproduce asexually. Or it could have been because female Aesir and Vanir, another branch of Norse gods, which includes Freyr, Freya, and Nord, especially in the 90s, might not have been as well known. Like how Freya and Frigg still often get confused with each other, and Sif and Sigyn, Sif is Sinin, when Sif is a priestess in some stories, or others. Strangely, you also never hear about Baldur as an individual. He was one of the most famous Aesir in mythology, being the one who dies and inevitably kicks off the path that led to or leads to Ragnarok, which may not have happened yet in the show since the world hasn't ended, but I know that's not accurate to the myths either. But perhaps he was already deceased before the show ever started, and the Baldur designated science class starship made by the Asgard and the Vanir, who are a rogue group of Asgards who don't actually show up until Stargate Atlantis. The myths tend to show that he is a bit of a brute, but also a protective individual, hence being worshipped as such. A father, a dedicated hero, and a son somewhat connected to Odin. Rather than following the mythology accurately at all, on a surface level, someone decided to go in a completely different direction by portraying Thor as an Asgardian. But, deeper down, he is a symbol of civilization, especially in spreading civilization. For the Vikings, that included acts of brutishness and brutality in exploration, conquest, and making land yours, also connecting to his aspect of agricultural fertility. It's becoming ever more clear that the creators and writers of the show may have borrowed some big ideas of which gods they wanted to work with from our world's history and mythology, but they are really creating their own variations of who the gods were to suit their own stories. It obviously doesn't mean that I don't like them, and it doesn't mean I'm stopping this series because there's not as much connection, but I think it does mean that just like how mythology and legends changed in ancient past and continue to change in the real world, this is just an extension of that. So why is Thor so valuable in the modern, or the 90s world? Coming from someone who grew up in the 90s and early 2000s, I am so far from supporting the old Viking brutality and most of what the mythological Thor stood for. For people in general, I'd hope, we don't want the people in charge or the gods people follow or our sci-fi betters, which are, you know, the more advanced civilizations, to be fighters, to be brutish, to want to destroy us or to solve the problems through conflict, unless that's the very last resort, especially against us. Not really into it. We wanted and want them to be peaceful, but strong, and above all, wise. Compassionate, caring. Strangely, the wisest of the mythological Aesir, or Asgard, don't seem to make appearances. They were probably the ones sitting back, not on the front lines making decisions, which the historical Vikings did appreciate sometimes, while other times not. But we are not Vikings. As a collective, we are older as a civilization now, and maybe following the path that SG-1 generally tried to follow, we can become worthy of being the fifth race. Thank you so much for listening to The Alien Nature of Thor. I hope you enjoyed this. If you did, please like and subscribe to the podcast, to my website. Leave a 5-star review, please, and leave a comment. I highly recommend going to the website and looking at all the pictures that go along with this article, all the artifacts, all the places. There are links in the description. There's also links to my Patreon, my Blue Sky account, my Instagram, where I have multiple different things coming up every week. And on my Patreon, I have bloopers on the drawing weeks. So I hope that you will enjoy it as I mess up a lot during these recordings. But thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I'm sorry for all of my pronunciation, names, and just words in general. I am sorry for all the crazy pronunciation of Icelandic words. I tried. Thank you for your patience. If you know of any corrections or you have more information or any questions, feel free to email me directly at detoursinarchaeology@gmail.com, or you can contact me really anywhere. And I have some merch in my website store. I have a shirt that says, "It est quand illa dixit." It means, "That's what she said" in Latin. I also have stickers, just small random things. I am on the Archaeology Podcast Network. So if you are new and listening to this for the first time, welcome. I really hope you enjoyed it. I mean, I hope you enjoyed it if you've listened to all of my episodes already. I have received some emails from people giving me different ideas about different things to do in the future. Thank you so much. I really do appreciate it. And I would very much like to write about some of the things that were talked about. Let me know if you want your name attributed when I do it. Otherwise, it can be anonymous. All the music is from Scott Buckley and can be found at his website at scottbuckley.com.au.
Connecting a little bit to what some of our stories, we have goats. So our fun fact this week is going to be about sheep and goats. They are believed to be the earliest livestock ever domesticated. This agricultural advancement occurred around 10,500 years ago in the Fertile Crescent region of Mesopotamia, an area that includes parts of modern-day Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and other countries. It's theorized that domesticated sheep are generally derived from the wild Asiatic Mulflan and Bezoar ibex, which were selectively bred to produce a domesticated animal that could be farmed for its meat. This remained the primary purpose of sheep for millennia, as they weren't bred for wool until approximately 6000 BCE. So around 8,000 years ago. Prior to being selectively bred for their wool, sheep were hairy, not fluffy, smaller than a typical sheep of today, and prominently had horns. So sheep came to resemble the animals we know no later than 3000 BCE, 5000 years ago, as evidenced by drawings from Mesopotamian and Babylonian art books of the era. In Mongolia today, you can see sheep and goats running together, and according to our guide when we were traveling, there could be goat-sheep hybrids. Although they are rare, but they are called geeps, or sometimes shoats, but apparently they are generally stillborns. But sheep in Mongolia do often have horns that battle each other. But they are so cute. I mean, maybe it's just because they're in Mongolia that the goats look like a sheep-goat hybrid because they're so much fluffier. The cows do too. They're hairier. They're not yaks, though. There's a difference between the cow cattle and yaks. Very different, but there are very fuzzy cows in Mongolia, and they are so adorable. Next week, we're going to talk about the god and, in Stargate, the cult leader, Seth.
But until then, stay curious, stay inspired, and keep taking those detours. Thanks again.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.